This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.
This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Info, and today I'm joined by our chairman of our county commission, Bill Novotny. Hello, Bill. Nice to see you.
Good afternoon, Kate. It's good to be with you.
And thank you very much for spending some time with 307 Net Info. I wanted to really get from you a sort of an overview of wildfire recovery from the house draw fire. It seems like it was ages ago, but in fact it's not even 3 weeks. But the fire is out and we're now moved very much into the recovery efforts. I've been at many meetings where these issues, and they're very complicated and tangled, where the recovery efforts have been discussed. But I wondered if you'd just sort of take us back to basics and just with your overview, describe the initial impact of the fire.
Well, I think, Kate, what is really important for your listeners to understand is just the magnitude of this fire. This fire is now classified as the largest fire in the history of Wyoming. We've got some fires that may be a little bit larger, but because they burned into other states. But so contained within the state of Wyoming, this is now the largest fire. Some of your listeners may remember the Cato Fire a couple years ago. That burned about 48,000 acres. This burned 175,000, roughly, and that's primarily all privately owned, deeded ground. There is some BLM and also some state land interspersed in that. But the majority of land that was burned in this fire are privately owned taxpayers.
And I think I've seen a figure around 84%.
Yes.
So that's more than a majority. That's, I mean, that's a significant
It is. If you look at ownership of land within Johnson County, 46% of all the land in Johnson County is owned by either the state or federal government. So when you burn an area where, in our checkerboard that we have in Johnson County, where 86% of it is owned by our friends and neighbors, the impact is huge. We were very, very fortunate that we didn't lose any primary structures, which you would consider people's homes. There were outbuildings, there was equipment, fences, corrals.
It came dang close for some people.
It really did. And we are eternally grateful for some operators who were out on blades, who were cutting fire lines around people's homes, for the ability to call in airstrikes with slurry fire retardant to either lay it on top of those homes or around those homes to protect them. You know, I feel for one homeowner, her house was white and now it's pink. Mm-hmm. Because of that fire retardant, but her home is still standing, which is a blessing in itself.
And of course, nobody was seriously injured and there was no loss of life, even in the firefighting.
Absolutely.
Efforts. And that is, with a blaze of that type, it was very fast moving, the winds were extreme and changing. That was very fortunate.
We are, and you have people that raced out to help their neighbors, and the fact that as that wind shifted, and at one point it was consuming 100 acres a minute, that nobody was caught behind a fire or was injured. So that we are eternally thankful for that. And what we also have to remember is that the scars of that experience are going to be long lasting. And so if you were out there watching your livelihood burn up and you were trying to protect it with whatever equipment you had, that's going to be a lasting impact to you. And so the physical scars, maybe we don't have any, but there are certainly some mental scars. And I think it's important that we recognize that whether you were a firefighter, a first responder, or you were out there as the ranch owner, that it's going to have a lasting impact on your mental health, because that was your livelihood that was put in jeopardy.
And is still in a great state of uncertainty. And that really leads us on.
Yes.
Next to what is happening. There is a recovery effort that is overseen by the county commissioners. Coordination falls into the emergency management coordinator, but it is a very, very complicated web because we have multiple agencies all trying to kind of help and
yes.
assist, but the processes and the red tape that have to be worked within are very complex. And I mean, very, very difficult. I've sat in a number of meetings and there are so many strings and pieces. But if you could describe in brief terms what the response effort needs to be, given the nature of our fire, the scale of it, as you say, also the terrain upon which it blazed and the people that it impacted.
So if you look at it on three levels of fences, foliage, and water, first priority right now is to get fences restored, whether it is a temporary or a permanent fix, because we essentially are, in a lot of parts of the burn scar, open range. The internal fences have been completely destroyed or are basically allowing livestock to move back and forth.
Essentially, on this 175,000 acres, there were livestock. Its principal purpose was for livestock grazing, and it may have been leased or it may be owned by the people who were actually using it for that. But those fences were burned and need to go back in. But the livestock cannot go back onto some of that burned land. But some of it is not that seriously damaged and can be utilized.
Absolutely. And so maybe you were a rancher out there that only half of your operation was hit by the fire. But maybe one of the things that you lost was that dividing fence between your spring pasture and your winter pasture. And so trying to get those fences back in place. So if we can restore those fences, and then we need to immediately pivot and look at the water. And this area where it's at, if you're fortunate enough to be along the Crazy Woman portion of the river that runs through there before it dumps into the Powder, or some of those seasonal areas that run some water part of the year, you're pretty well dependent on either reservoirs or pipelines and wells. And so if you had tanks, or even if you had valves that were above ground that were part of your pipelines that were in the path of this fire, a lot of them have been destroyed. So we've got to get those fences either temporarily restored or permanently restored, which will be part of the longer term effort, which is where you run into all the bureaucratic issues that our producers are seeing right now about how quickly they can start to put their lives back together. But getting that water back and running, and whether it was maybe you had wells that were powered by Precor, which is Powder River Energy, and so there were poles that carried power out to where you're at. Those poles were burned up. The power lines have been on the ground. Thank goodness those guys have been out there working to restore. And I've heard in the neighborhood of 400 power poles were lost out in this burn scar. So you're trying to restore the power for that. Then if you had a solar well or your tanks were burned up, then you're going to be working on getting those restored. And maybe you're not going to necessarily graze that right now. Excuse me. But we need to get that water back online for wildlife.
We'll just pause for a moment. So we've got fences and water and foliage. You wanted to mention foliage specifically. What is the issue with foliage that we need to be concerned about?
Well, number one, we're very, very concerned about invasive weeds that may come into these disturbed areas and choke out our native grasses. We have a new invasive weed, Vedinata, that is moving rapidly down from Sheridan County and showing up in places in Johnson County. And the problem with Vedinata is that livestock and wildlife will not consume it. They've done test plots in Sheridan County. The wildlife and the livestock graze right up to the edge of the Vedinata. They don't browse into it. So it really could be very devastating to the carrying capacity.
Because it also squeezes out the indigenous and even cheatgrass varieties.
Yes, so very, very aggressive. The other thing that we know, that some of the areas that are burned are areas that could be prone to have leafy spurge. Fire does not destroy the seeds of leafy spurge.
And maybe you would explain why leafy spurge is a concern.
So leafy spurge, we have that down in the Clear Creek Valley and further as you get out into the Powder. Again, a plant that is very, very aggressive. It has, again, really no value for most livestock. You hear some people that can graze goats on it and some other things, but we have tried for years to eradicate leafy spurge from Johnson County. They've used beetles. They've used chemicals, kind of focused grazing. What we don't want to see is that leafy spurge shows up in some of these draws where we haven't seen it in the past, and maybe the seed was laying dormant and it decides to show up, or it gets transported. We're very, very concerned in terms of protecting our native foliage also and our flora and fauna here, that as producers are bringing in hay and supplemental feed from elsewhere, we want to make sure that also we're not bringing in any new invasive species of weeds that could impact our county. So we'll be really watching that. We're asking producers to be mindful of where they're going to do their supplemental feeding. We're actually going to try to GPS locate those spots so that we can do monitoring as the weed and pests works through this long recovery process, because you're going to have producers that are going to maybe be feeding hay in areas that they don't typically feed hay because their operations have changed. So a lot to look at there.
So there's so many things to think about. It's almost every time you turn over an issue, there's something else underneath it. You did call for an assessment, and so to really try and understand what was impacted from each of the individual landowners. What did that assessment show you? What kind of quantities and so on were you able to get from that, and how does it help to guide the recovery effort?
So our preliminary livestock losses were lower than probably what a lot of people thought. The problem with that is that that number is going to grow. And so if you have livestock that either burned its feet, maybe its bag, or was exposed to a lot of smoke and is developing respiratory issues, those things are starting to show up now.
So it's not as simple as some livestock was burned because it wasn't able to move out of the way, but there is others that are going to, you're going to see a longer term impact,
and
maybe even possibly on yield of, you know, how many will calf properly next season.
Yes, you have our sheep ranchers haven't even turned their bucks in yet for next year's lamb crop, and so that is something that we haven't even contemplated yet about what that's going to do to their operations. You know, you're hoping that they were one of the fortunate ones and that their sheep are on the mountain on a grazing either allotment or deeded ground up there. But we have a lot of sheep ranchers in southern Johnson County that their sheep are down. And so I know of one producer who was hoping that his sheep had moved on to the neighbors. They're now thinking that maybe they have a loss of 300 or 400 sheep. They're trying to locate the remains of those sheep so you can prove the loss. So, our initial livestock loss, and it was right after the fire, that was primarily of what people could see that had been burned to death, and they had. That number is going to go up significantly. And again, you have that continued cost for those producers who are trying to doctor this livestock, trying to get them out of it, trying to keep those calves on feed because they're going to be shipping them pretty soon, and that's their livelihood. So a prolonged impact for some of those folks that maybe they didn't lose that animal right away, but maybe it's weeks or months after the fire is out.
One of the things I guess is more quantifiable is some of the structural things that you mentioned earlier. For example, you know, how many wells are damaged or destroyed in some regard, how many miles of fences. Do we know those details yet?
We are at over 600 miles of fence, and that's growing. And interestingly, one of the discussions prior to meeting with you, Kate, I was at FSA meeting with Southern Johnson County producers, which I know you went to the one in Buffalo last week where we got inundated with acronym soup about all of the different programs and the deadlines. But we have one rancher who had steel posts but lost 96 wooden braces for his fences. And so they don't really know how to classify that under their system. So is that a repair? Is that a rebuild? Is it a complete reconstruction? But bottom line, he's got to get those braces back in because he's got to get that fence stretched tight. And then what happens when he does put those braces in? Is the wire so brittle from the heat exposure that it's going to break? And so I think our preliminary fence estimates are very, very low. I think that there are a lot of producers who didn't realize just how many miles of fence they had in their operation. You know, it's a fence that's been up there that their parents or grandparents put up. And so
there are some also some, because of the magnitude, the scale of the fire, there are some really challenging logistical problems of how you get that much material and then people in to actually install that new fence and how you go about it. You've also got the, I mean, dizzying, it's complexity of working the systems if you are a rancher or a landowner, you know, to try and keep your personal overhead as low as possible and to get the maximum effect out of some of the aid and that is available. And there is aid available, and I hope we'll talk about that in detail in a moment. But we still really are getting our arms around the cost.
We are. And the preliminary estimate is over $25 million, and that is people are able to determine what pipelines are still operational.
So what is included within that $25 million? Does that include the local firefighting initiative as well?
That is a separate other figure.
Because that's been touted to be somewhere in the region between $5 and $6
million. It is. And that number in our fire system is very, very good between our local fire district, the Office of state land, state forestry that kind of tag team that effort, and then the BLM folks who were involved. They have a wonderful system of tracking those costs and what each load of slurry costs and all of those things. We have kind of a little bit of, I guess, two different insurance policies for the short term on that. The fire district, whether it's Johnson County Fire 1 or Powder River Fire District, has fire suppression reserve accounts. And that's what those special districts build those reserves for, because they deplete them very, very quickly in a fire of this scope. Once you hit a cost ceiling on some of these fires, then there's a bigger state account, the fire suppression account, that is restocked with money from the legislature every year. That money can be put towards the cost of fighting this fire. Again, these are going to be reimbursable things. So our fire district here has been paying to get the fuel in those trucks and the everything to get them out there and the meals to feed the firefighters. So they have a lot of costs and expense that they have incurred that maybe.
And for 2 or 3 days, it was just our local guys until we got, it got
yes.
escalated and ultimately got escalated to a very superior federal team, but they were still all involved.
Yeah, very much so. They were the initial attack and the ones that really were responsible for saving a lot of those structures. And some of those costs that we can show to the Federal Emergency Management Agency may be reimbursable, but that is a slow, long process. I think that process is even slower and more cumbersome than the programs within the U.S. Department of Agriculture that our producers are going to be able to tap into. Provided, one, that we get that full disaster declaration from the Secretary of Agriculture. Otherwise, a lot of the options will be limited. There still will be assistance. And Governor Gordon sent that letter in last week. Our congressional delegation also sent supporting letters to the Secretary of Agriculture asking for that designation, which will open up a lot of different programs and assistance to those folks. Again, most of those programs are a cost share, and they have a ceiling. And when you have 30 or 40 miles of fence plus 2 or 3,000 acres of ground that you need to treat for cheatgrass, that cost share money is going to be eaten up very, very quickly. And that's why we'll be looking at every avenue, every partnership with any entity that wants to help in this recovery, whether it's public or private. You know, work with the Wyoming Game and Fish, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, any of the bird groups that are interested in sage grouse. We're willing to partner with anybody so that we can help this area recover, because it is it's a livelihood area for our ranching community, but it's also critical wildlife habitat.
And from that also, there is a very healthy hunting
very healthy
economy as well. You only have to be in one of those discussions for a few moments to realize that there is a lot of aid, but that it doesn't make a landowner whole.
No, it really doesn't.
And it's very complicated getting to that point.
Very much so. And right now, our producers are having to ask for waivers so that they don't jeopardize future payments just to do things like get their perimeter fences back up or get a portion of a fence up so they can gather, so they can ship their livestock elsewhere. So, and same goes with if they need to repair a water system. And they have to send that waiver in, and a county committee at FSA looks at it. And now it sounds from the meeting that I was just in, then that even after they grant the waiver, it still gets looked at the state FSAs. So, just a lot of bureaucratic, slow-moving hurdles and problems for people who just want to get to work. They just want to start pounding posts and try to get on with their lives.
So there is aid in all, from a multitude of places. There's FEMA, there's Wyoming State Aid, and so on. Can you just give us a sort of painted little picture of what there is and how it works? And what I'd really like to kind of get to is what kind of costs are going to ultimately be borne by the property owners and the property taxpayers of Johnson County.
So there are, through USDA, through the Farm Service Administration or the Natural Resource Conservation Office, there are going to be cost shares, and those are typically 75, 25, or 70, 30 in that neighborhood for rebuilding fences, repairing water systems, corrals, and also dealing with noxious weeds. There are some other programs under Farm Service Administration that will help with livestock loss, trucking costs, supplemental feed. Certainly there will also be some avenues to look at some FEMA dollars to help with some of those emergency things that producers might have impacted. I'm still trying to figure out how to unravel how the FEMA dollars are going to work, because certainly we don't see anybody from FEMA in here on the ground right now, like we've had in the past when we've had flooding, where the FEMA guys set up an office and basically the county went door to door to figure out who needed the FEMA help, and then you sent them to the FEMA's temporary office. Nobody from FEMA's here on the ground right now. We have our local folks that work in the offices up on Lott Street, or the folks that are up in Sheridan that are at least coming down here to do office hours. But it is very, very daunting to figure out where you start, how you accumulate the data that you're going to need, because they need maps of fences. And the nice thing that the county has a very, very good map system that is overseen by our planning office. And so we are helping those producers put those maps together. And if they've ever worked with Allison at the NRSC on different projects, then she probably has a lot of the mapping data. But we have a lot of people who don't have any of that. And so trying to help them get that map of that place and then sketch out where that fence line was so they can take it and have the data that they need. And they're having to take pictures, not only of dead livestock, but of destroyed water structures or where fences used to be. Just many, many monumental steps.
And there is presumably, as well as in many things government, a time lag between when you submit and you may know that you're eligible, but before the check actually arrives in your mailbox. And there is another headache
Absolutely. And that's a key point that I'm glad you brought that up, Kate, because you can't receive compensation under the cost share program until the particular project. So let's say it's a 6-mile fencing project and you fix 3 miles of it and then you have to wait for more materials.
All spring.
Yes. It's not reimbursable until the project is done and they have been out to inspect it.
But the people who put it in
are
going to want their money right
away.
So there is an issue that has to be navigated with that. So do we know, do we have any idea, you used the $25 million figure, the cost of that, how much is that going to be borne by Johnson County?
So the county...
Unknown.
Unknown. What the impact to those producers it's going to be. We're still working on what the fire's impact to the county itself was. Luckily, we didn't lose... we had a bridge that was a wood top bridge out in the burn scar that didn't have any damage. We lost some road signs. We didn't lose any equipment while we were fighting the fire. It was manpower, fuel, and those things. So impact to the Johnson County proper, not nearly the scale of what it could have been.
There is another cost, of course, which is the economic impact. There is economic impact which is being felt very acutely by those landowners and ranchers. But what about the more general local economy? Do you have a sense of how that may trickle out into our local economy?
So we are a tourist destination for outdoor recreation, and so you have a lot of non-resident hunters who came and have been coming for years out to hunt in this area, whether they hunt with an outfitter or they hunt on a ranch or they hunt the public ground. And even though there wasn't a lot of public ground that was burned in this fire, it still has a huge impact on the wildlife. And
a significant displacement.
Absolutely. And so you've already had the Game and Fish is offering to try to refund folks' tags that went through the draw and drew in those areas. Certainly for some of the leftover tags that people can buy over the counter for Dauphin deer, those folks aren't going to probably come to Johnson County. They're going to look elsewhere in the state because they had probably been planning to come to Johnson County. And so not only is it going to impact the ranchers that maybe they hunted on, it's going to be less heads in beds in our motels or using our campgrounds, less folks visiting the grocery stores, the restaurants, the sporting goods stores, buying fuel while they're here. And the impact that we haven't even really tried to figure out to quantify, a lot of the wild game that is harvested by those non-residents gets donated to the food pantry. And so that becomes a major source of protein to supplement the meals of residents of our county who are living on the margins. And so it's going to get harder for our food pantry if they lose that donated meat that we have the potential of if you have less hunters that are here to visit or our local folks who may harvest an extra doe and donate it to the food pantry. Those are just things that we're just starting to scratch the surface on about how it's going to impact us.
And presumably that's not just for this upcoming season. It's going to take a while for that land to kind of grow back and recover and for those wildlife herds to repopulate those areas and in another conversation, yep. I'll put a link to that in this audio. We talked a lot about the environmental impact of that with some experts in that area, but we're talking about multiple seasons. This is going to impact our hunting and outfitting, and all, as you say, all those other businesses that support visitors
absolutely
coming to our community at a time outside traditional high summer tourist season.
Our shoulder season, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. So, turning to recovery plans, do you have a strategy for this? How are you going to manage this very complicated web of different elements that all need to be navigated in different ways with different requirements?
So, luckily, as part of our emergency management department, they have all sorts of plans for different situations, and there is a planning process, and Jimmy is working through the recovery strategy, whether it's dealing with the debris, and we'll have two different types of debris. You're going to have the fencing debris that comes out of this fire, and then we may have, depending on as we discover livestock losses, we may have a lot of carcasses that are going to be need to be dealt with, because what we don't want to do is jeopardize any of our water quality in any of those areas. And so he's already working on that. We'll have working groups within our disaster recovery plan that are working on those fences, because it's a combination of you may be neighbor to state land or BLM land. And so there's multiple parties that are involved in those fencing decisions. There'll be lots of players in the wildlife discussion, from the Fish and Wildlife Service to the Game and Fish to the conservation districts. Obviously, there will be a working group that's focused entirely on noxious and invasive weed control and treatment. And so you'll have those components, but that's just a part of it. And then you lean on the community to also help take care of its own. And that's why it's wonderful you see not only the Wyoming Stock Growers Association has a fund that's set up, but we have our own local community fund that is going to be raising money to help with those things that either don't qualify or to help these folks bridge that gap until you have our extension agent who is coordinating the donated feed, whether it's hay or grain and other things that are being offered. We even have veterinary medical companies that are donating drugs to our local vets so they can treat the respiratory illness that we're seeing in some of the cattle and sheep right now. So all of those recovery efforts, and you know, we do these tabletop exercises and we sign off on all these plans, and then you think that we have the perfect plan, and then you have a situation like this fire that maybe doesn't fit in all the boxes of what you planned for. And so then we're having to adapt to the situation. And, you know, in a lot of our emergency plans, there's a lot of focus on sheltering and housing of people. But luckily, we're not dealing with that. It's loss of fence and loss of grass. And so a little different than anything that we planned for.
But that is livelihood.
It is, very much so.
It looks to people who don't utilize that land as if it's scrub prairie, but actually it's very valuable and it is livelihood. And there is a huge psychological impact of having seen your father's, your grandfather's, your great-grandfather's legacy burn black. And it will stay like that for some considerable amount of time. You may have also been involved in the firefighting efforts yourself. And, you know, those are very traumatic and stressful events. And I know there's been a lot of emphasis put on, you know, mental health and mental health support as well. And that there are services specifically that can help support people through this very challenging time.
There are. There's going to be an ag stress symposium that I just saw some information for that's coming up, and it had nothing to do with this wildfire. It just is timing, and I think that we're finally having those candid discussions about mental health that we needed to have a long time ago, and I'm glad that mental health is being discussed in our recovery efforts, because it is real, and it is a part of our healthcare system, and you know, getting those, and particularly a lot of the folks that are impacted, some of them are veterans, and so they're going to have access to VA resources. But if you're just an ag producer, you're already at a higher rate nationally of depression, thoughts of suicide, and other situations. And that's why I so commend the ranching community in KC that's embraced the mental health efforts down there and the things that they do. And those are things that are hard if in your community, the community mental health center doesn't have any clinicians that can see you, or the only clinician that can see you wants to do a Skype. That makes us concerned, and we're looking, and that's a whole nother conversation.
Which I hope we can follow up on. Yes, indeed.
We absolutely will.
But I agree with you that it's really very good to see mental health being, right from the very beginning, being a consideration and an important factor in every conversation about how we can support and make ourselves back whole again. If somebody is you know, in the community, they're not necessarily associated with somebody who may have been directly impacted by this, what do you think residents in our community can do to sort of support and assist with recovery efforts?
You know, first and foremost, it's those check-ins on your friends and neighbors, or maybe they have a kid that plays on your child's sports team or has a practice, and so it's offering to give the kid a ride home or sending a meal or those little things. And then as we see our community efforts stand up, and you have businesses in this community that are doing profit shares, they're doing roundup for different things. You can donate directly to the relief efforts. I know there's groups that are in the planning stages of doing some bigger fundraisers so that we can generate some dollars to help those. Maybe it's even offering to go out and help roll up wire.
I believe Summit Church are coordinating.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, if you want to donate money, great, and there are lots of ways to do that, and I will make sure that links are attached to this audio file. But if you don't want to give money, or you give money but you also want to give something else, time and ability, Summit Church are coordinating literally hands to do to fill in all the gaps that need to be filled in.
There are, and that's incredible, and that's what's so great about a small community and a resilient community, is that we find ways to help people that normally you wouldn't think of. You know, it's a rough day if you're getting ready to ship most of your livestock, but if somebody could help you get the meal ready so that the friends and neighbors that help you ship, so that's one less thing that your family has to be stressed about. Those are just some great things.
Well, that also costs money.
And it does. And when you are really looking at how you're going to hold it all together going forward, every little help is so important.
So looking forward, we're not necessarily out of fire season.
We are not.
You know, heaven forbid that it would happen, but we're not necessarily out of fire season this season, and we have no good reason to believe that we could be in any less risk next season. Should we be preparing for in more proactively?
We really should. And Kate, one of the things that I want to stress to people, if you have not signed up for the Code Red emergency system, please do so. Every once in a while there's a little bit of a hiccup and you don't like that it goes off in the middle of the night. But I tell you, if you were out in your home on Cook Road and that went off to tell you that you needed to evacuate, that's so important. And you know, we have relied on our community radio station that is questionable about what its future is like. We can't broadcast those emergency announcements over KBBS because it's not functioning right now.
And that would indeed, require people to be on.
Yes, to have the radio on. Just as
Code Red is so valuable because it's actually on people's cell phones.
It's on your
and
cell phone.
And it will come on your email, and you can have it sent to your landline as a voice message too. So it is more likely to catch up with you.
It really is. Certainly more than the ticker that goes across your TV with the announcement. And as people have disconnected from cable, if they don't have that way to communicate with them. That's why that code red is so important. And also just preparedness. And we look and we've done a lot of work in the county in our urban interface on the mountain around cabins. And we've worked to do our rural addressing up there and clear fire breaks around people's property to help protect them. But those same things we need to be thinking out in the...
Is there a plan for that?
There is a effort that is going to have to be redoubled, because in our planning process, I think that's something that we have overlooked, just because you look at the concentration of houses and you're trying to plan for the greatest loss of human life or human property, and you tend to forget those other things, or you don't plan enough for them. And so that is going to have to be a redoubled effort of our range fires, because we put so much emphasis, because typically it comes with some sort of funding assistance to put those FireWise plans in safe. And unfortunately, you don't see that out on what we would consider our prairie country. And so we're going to have to redouble our efforts there. And it's folks, you know, you've got a couple ranchers who have cut fire lines around their pastures. And some of them are visible from I-25, those fire lines, because they realize we are not out of the woods yet. We're not out of the woods until the snow is on the ground. I think shortly before I became a commissioner, we had a fire on Windy Ridge in November, and it threatened ranches and homes, and that was started at the gun range. And so we are a long ways of being out of the woods in terms of fire. So people in their daily lives need to be vigilant. We had, while this fire was burning, we had 5 fires down by KC. One of them was started, and it started to burn towards KC because somebody was going down the interstate on a rim. And it was sparking. So just remember that we've got to be vigilant in our everyday activities to prevent fire.
Of course, fire is not the only emergency, natural emergency that we could encounter either, but probably the most likely.
Yes.
Would that be fair to say?
I think
we're not
in a
high flood area, and the dryness and the conditions, I mean, it's really just a tinderbox.
It really is right now. And last year was a good year in terms of growth of grasses. And so we have above average fuel load in some places that has dried out substantially. And so the fire danger is there very much. So I think either yesterday afternoon we went under a red flag warning because of low pressure with high winds, with low humidity, which makes it perfect to see fire conditions like what we had during the house draw fire.
Yes, indeed. And I would encourage people, again, to, you know, look into Code Red and to sign up for that. It is, I have a separate feature with the emergency management coordinator about it, and you won't be disturbed for everything. He really tries to geofence down to different locations. Only the people who really need to receive that information.
Yes.
So it's not going to be going off, 24 hours a day by any means. But so there is so much to do. There is a tremendous amount of recovery. It's easy for those of us who are not directly involved to think the fire is out. Let's just hope there's not another one. But of course, we don't know what next season is going to bring.
Absolutely.
Either, or the season after it. And do you have an idea of how long it's going to take for Johnson County to recover?
This is going to be a 3 to 5 year recovery before we are back to what we were pre-fire. And that's a long prognosis. A lot of the return of the rain conditions, the range conditions, excuse me, that we had pre-fire are going to be dependent on some rainfall this fall and then a normal precipitation level during the winter. If we don't have that, the other thing that we're going to have to prepare for, which thank goodness we have such a great crew at the Johnson County Weed and Pest, is that they anticipate next year is going to be a high concentration of grasshoppers. So just a litany of different things that are going to impact our recovery, but this is going to be a long process. We need Mother Nature to help us out a little bit and get some moisture in a way that doesn't cause erosion out in that area. So we don't want all that moisture to come in one storm and wash away the exposed topsoil or cause silting into the reservoirs out there that maybe are dry right now. So just a long process. Plus, if you put everybody in the county to work on a fence crew, we still wouldn't have enough people to rebuild the fences. It's going to be a long time for those ag producers to get all those fences put back in.
You raise a question which I probably should have asked earlier, which is about spraying for those invasive species and just spraying generally. And what is going to happen to, you know, what kind of pressure is that going to put on weed and pest and also on the cost of those things?
Well, luckily, Weed and Pest is working on their strategy. We're recruiting landowners right now that are inside the burn scar that are interested in being part of this coordinated effort to treat for cheatgrass and vintnata. They realize that a lot of it's going to have to be done by the air. They're not going to be able to do it with hand crews. There are rough areas where we're going to need to treat it with a helicopter. And so it's a good thing that we've got Reno Air Service here who can go out and get in those areas that treat it that otherwise we wouldn't be able to. And so it will be a huge undertaking that then are also going to have the recovery efforts of the two fires in Campbell County plus the fire in Sheridan County that burned into Montana that will take resources away in terms of people that can spray. We'll also be competing with them for fencing material. And so it is going to be a long process. But
is there supplemental aid for that as well?
There could be. The Weed and Pest District has applied for a grant with the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust for $5 million. We kind of did preliminary figures of just the chemical to treat the impacted area is about $8 million. And that's before you apply it anywhere. So, again, the weed treatment, that'll be a cost-share effort. So if we can do things to help cut the cost and lessen the impact on our producers, then hopefully we can get more areas treated. And what's nice, they're being very strategic about the planning of where they're going to target to spray. They know where we've had cheatgrass in the past. They've been able to use some satellite imagery, and so they're looking at a burn severity index so they know areas where maybe the soil was sterilized and that they're going to need to maybe go in and do some reseeding, whereas areas where the fire moved quickly and didn't maybe burn the seed bank there so that some of those native grasses hopefully will be able to come back. So they're using a lot of science. Using those partnerships where they have with the University of Wyoming and also with our other partners in the Game and Fish and the Fish and Wildlife Service and the two conservation districts, plus the NRSC to kind of blend all of that data that everybody has together so they have a really, really good plan of how they're going to attack those invasive grasses.
But they truly are invasive and they don't like to die. And it is, I mean, invasive species, invasive grasses are going to be an issue which are going to repeatedly come back.
They are.
As very challenging, both economically and on a practical level. We do not yet have some kind of mechanism to permanently erase the challenge that they present.
We don't, and that's one of the things that Alan and his team is going to really have to figure out, because they're going to treat it once. And then they're probably going to need to come back in 3 to 5 years to treat those areas again. And so associated cost with fire recovery that you don't think about, but we all have to be planning for and how we're going to pay for that.
So we've talked a lot about cost. Where is that money ultimately all going to come from?
Unfortunately, we will have to rely, if we can get our disaster declaration on our federal programs that are available, but a lot of it will be borne by the folks that are impacted, because most of these programs are cost share. And so hopefully these recovery efforts and these partnerships with non-governmental agencies and entities and able to pair up and do grant match and lower that cost. But these producers are going to be drastically impacted financially by this. And so we just need to be aware that there isn't a magical pot of money that's going to solve all of these problems. It's they're going to have a lot of skin in the game.
And how many landowners and property owners are we talking about?
There are about 40 to 50 entities that are impacted, and some of them are ranch corporations, it's lessees, about that many folks.
In a community of our size, that's a significant number.
That's significant. It really is. And
because they're all families, and
absolutely.
Every part of that family is going to feel the consequence of this.
They are, and maybe the husband is out on the ranch, but his wife maybe is in town that teaches, or is a nurse, or vice versa. And so I think of Dr. Ruby. Just how it is going to impact us for years to come.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your time, Chairman. Dizzying complexity.
Yes.
Very many different things to keep spinning all at one time. Thank you for providing with us a sort of an overview of really the challenge ahead. And I wish you well.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you.
This is 307 Net Info, unedited and unfiltered.